Pakistan have put military victory on the top of its priorities list, the time has come to talk to militants with guns and resistance. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
In the limelight.
Jeffrey A. Rosen, who was acting Attorney General during the Trump administration, has told the Justice Department watchdog and congressional investigators that one of his deputies tried to help former President Donald J. Trump subvert the results of the 2020 election, according to a person familiar with the interview. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Katie Banner. The piece is titled, Former Acting Attorney General Testifies About Trump's Efforts to Subvert Election. Jeffrey A. Rosen, who was acting Attorney General during the Trump administration, has told the Justice Department watchdog and congressional investigators that one of his deputies tried to help former President Donald J. Trump subvert the results of the 2020 election, according to a person familiar with the interviews. Mr. Rosen had a two-hour meeting on Friday, 6th of August, with the Justice Department's Office of the Inspector General, and provided closed-door testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee on Saturday, 7th of August. The investigations were opened after a New York Times article that detailed efforts by Jeffrey Clark, the acting head of the Justice Department's Civil Division, to push Trump leaders to falsely and publicly assert that continuing election fraud investigations cast doubt on the Electoral College results. That prompted former President Donald Trump to consider ousting Jeffrey A. Rosen and installing Jeffrey Clark at the top of the department to carry out that plan. Donald Trump never fired Mr. Rosen, but the plot highlights the former president's desire to batter the Justice Department into advancing his personal agenda. Jeffrey Clark, who did not respond to requests for comment, said in January that all of his official communications with the White House were consistent with law, and that he had engaged in a candid discussion of options and pros and cons with the president. Jeffrey A. Rosen did not respond to requests for comment. The Inspector General spokesman also declined to comment. Former Acting Attorney General Jeffrey A. Rosen has emerged as a key witness in multiple investigations that focus on Donald Trump's efforts to undermine the results of the election. He has publicly stated that the Justice Department did not find enough fraud to affect the outcome of the election. On Friday, 6th of August, Mr. Rosen told investigators from the Inspector General's office about five encounters with Mr. Clark, including one in late December, during which his deputy admitted to meeting with Donald Trump and pledged that he would not do so again, according to a person familiar with the interview. Jeffrey Rosen also described subsequent exchanges with Jeffrey Clark, who continued to press colleagues to make statements about the election that they found to be untrue, according to a person familiar with the interview. He also discovered that Jeffrey Clark had been engaging in unauthorized conversations with Donald Trump about ways to have the Justice Department publicly cast doubt on President Biden's victory, particularly in battleground states that Donald Trump was fixated on, like Georgia. Jeffrey Clark drafted a letter that he asked Jeffrey Rosen to send to Georgia state legislators, wrongly asserting that they should void Joe Biden's victory because the Justice Department was investigating accusations of voter fraud in the state. Such a letter would effectively undermine efforts by Jeffrey Clark's colleagues to prevent the White House from overturning the election results. And Jeffrey A. Rosen and his top deputy, Richard Donahue, rejected the proposal. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, said Mr. Rosen discussed previously reported episodes, including his interactions with Jeffrey Clark with the Senate Judiciary Committee. He called Jeffrey Rosen's account dramatic evidence of how intent Donald Trump was in overturning the election result. Senator Richard Blumenthal was one of a handful of senators, including Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, and Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat of Rhode Island, who sat through most of Jeffrey Rosen's more than 6 hours of testimony. Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois and chairman of the committee, Charles E. Grassley, Republican of Iowa, Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, Ben Sasse, Republican of Nebraska, and Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, attended parts of the interview. Senator Richard Blumenthal said Mr. Rosen presented new facts and evidence that led him to believe that the committee would need to answer profound and important questions about the roles that individuals in Donald Trump's orbit played in the effort to undermine the peaceful transition of power, which is what Donald Trump tried to do intently and concertedly. As details of Jeffrey Clark's actions emerge, it is unclear what, if any, consequences he could face. The Justice Department's Inspector General could make a determination about whether Jeffrey Clark crossed the line into potentially criminal behavior. In that case, the Inspector General could refer the matter to federal prosecutors. Jeffrey Rosen has spent much of the year in discussions with the Justice Department over what information he could provide to investigators, given that decision-making conversations between administration officials are usually kept confidential. Douglas A. Collins, a lawyer for Donald Trump, said last week that the former president would not seek to bar former Justice Department officials from speaking with investigators. But Douglas Collins said he might take some undisclosed legal action if congressional investigators sought privileged information. Mr. Rosen quickly scheduled interviews with congressional investigators to get as much of his version of events on the record before any players could ask the courts to block the proceedings, according to two people familiar with those discussions who are not authorized to speak about continuing investigations. Jeffrey Rosen also reached out directly to Michael Horowitz, the Justice Department's Inspector General, and pledged to cooperate with his investigation, according to a person briefed on those talks.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
اللهم اغفر لي الذنوب التي تحبس الدعاء اللهم اغفر لي الذنوب التي تنزل البلاء اللهم اغفر لي كل ذنب أذنبته وكل خطية أخطأتها اللهم إني أتقرب إليك بذكرك وأستشفع بك إلى نفسك.
Brothers and sisters, we were talking about the phrase in which Imam عليه السلام says, اللهم اغفر لي الذنوب التي تحبس الدعاء. O Allah, forgive me the sins which hold back supplication. Regarding this phrase, we touched upon a tradition from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam mentioning the different sins causing the supplications to be held back and causing the supplications not to be accepted. We talked about a couple of them, and the third one was hypocrisy. We discussed hypocrisy, and we talked about the different facts causing this hypocrisy to be created in our minds and hearts. We mentioned arrogance, and now we are going to talk about negligence. When humans are neglectful of the realities, they are easily deluded by material issues. And this is an obscene and dangerous deed, being negligent. Those who are deceived by the worldly wealth deny the fact that this world is a place to be transited from, that one day they would be placed in graves, their body be devoured by the insects, their souls would be entangled by their wrongdoing, and they will be chastised in hereafter. These people consider this world as concrete and hereafter as an abstract. They stick to the passing world and they forget about the permanent one. They believe in worldly pleasures, but they doubt about the heavenly rewards. They do not accept, and they don't want to accept, Almighty Allah's promise revealed to 124,000 prophets and the infallible Imams. They don't want to be believers, nor avoid the sins and do virtues. These are the negligent individuals. They are heedless of the Quranic fact that hereafter is the consequence of apparent and hidden acts of this world. As the Prophet of Islam ﷺ states, this world is a place of action, the outcome of which is granted in the other world. This world and the other world are therefore not separate entities, and the hereafter is, in other words, a reflection of this world. But alas, the ignorant do not understand. The believers who are negligent of the Quranic verses are easily deluded by their conception of Almighty Allah's mercy. They think that since Almighty Allah's blessings and His mercy are expanded for all beings, there is no need to worship and serve Allah, and no need to take trouble in avoiding sins. They think that their sins are very little in proportion to Almighty Allah's forgiveness and mercy, and they think we would be saved due to our belief in Allah, due to our affection to His prophets and infallible Imams. So our sins would not lead us away, and surely we will have His mercy. These individuals are heedless and do not know that Satan deceives people with these apparent ideas.
Oh, first of the foremost, oh, last existence after the last. Oh Allah, forgive me my such sins which tear away my safeguards. Oh Allah, forgive me my such sins as would bring down calamity. Oh Allah, forgive me my sins that would change your favor. Oh Allah, forgive me my sins that would hinder my supplications. Oh Allah, forgive me my sins which descend misfortunes. Oh Allah, forgive my sins that suppress hope. Oh Allah, forgive every sin that I have committed and every error that I have earned. Oh Allah, I seek to draw myself nearer to you through your invocation, and I pray to you to intercede on my behalf. And I beg you by your benevolence to draw me nearer to you and grant thankfulness towards you and inspire me to remember and to invoke you. Oh Allah, I ask you begging submissively, humbly and awe-strickenly, to treat me with clemency and mercy, and to make me pleased and content with what you have granted me, and cause me to be modest and unassuming in all circumstances.
The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam states, a smart person is the one who opposes his carnal soul and do well for his hereafter. A foolish person is the one that follows his carnal soul and foolishly hopes Almighty Allah's mercy. Such people are negligent, and the generous Allah, whose mercy embraces all things, has promised to severely chastise habitual and arrogant sinners. Allah has given good tidings to the righteous and brave Muslims that only they are subjected to His mercy. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ هَاجَرُوا وَجَاهَدُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أُولَٰئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ. Those who believe and those who emigrate to escape the persecution and strive in the way of Allah, these have hope of His mercy. So, having hope of Almighty Allah's mercy, together with being simultaneously engaged in wrongdoing and living your duties, is actually deluding yourself. And this is an erroneous hope. Once Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was said, some people are polluted with a variety of sins, and they are still hopeful of His mercy. They continue wrongdoing until their death. Imam alayhi salam answered, هَؤُلَاءِ قَوْمٌ يَتَرَجَّحُونَ فِي الْأَمَانِي. These are the people who have fluctuating wishes. They are not really hopeful. One who is hopeful follows his hope, and one who is afraid of something escapes from it. Let's end this discussion by listening to one of the traditions from the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He says, لا تغترن بالله ولا تغترن بصلاحك وعلمك وعملك وبرك وعبادتك. Don't get negligence of Almighty Allah and get deceived by your own worship. Don't get deceived by your knowledge and good deeds. So, dear listeners, this is one of these sins that hold back supplication. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
guide me all the way to your Jannah. Yeah, Allah, yeah, Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close, close to you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at open areas around the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms. In a statement, Hezbollah said it hit open fields near Israeli positions at 11:15 a.m. local time Friday using dozens of 122-caliber rockets. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television said at least 20 rockets were fired at Israel's military positions. Al-Minar TV said a number of the rockets targeted the Duf military base. A Lebanese security source said the rockets were launched from the area of Al-Arkoub, near the Lebanese town of Sheba. Air raid sirens sounded in the Upper Galilee and in the Golan Heights, part of the territory Israel occupied in 1967. Israeli media said residents of settlements in the north of the occupied territories had been asked to stay in homes. The development came after Israeli jets struck what the regime's military claimed were sites where rockets had been launched earlier in the week.
Bombing Syria, bombing Lebanon is a way of their practice, a way of dividing new states and new communities to get legitimization for their sick political Zionist project. They try everything. They try everything to forbid building a civil state because this is their real threat to their ideology. Defending our land should not be alone through weapons and fighting, but with completing this with a political project which should be contradicted to the sick ideology of Zionism.
Regional resistance movements, including Palestinian Hamas and Yemeni Ansarullah, hailed their retaliatory attacks as a legitimate right against Israeli aggressions. Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabi Berri, said in a statement that the attacks on his country reflected the true nature of Israel. He added that the regime only understands the language of, quote, unity and resistance. President Michel Aoun also denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and the stability of the region. Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem also said the resistance movement is committed to the principle that any aggression on Lebanon will be met with a proper response, and for this reason, it responded to the aggressive enemy with rockets. He, however, downplayed the possibility that the situation would escalate to a full-blown war.
Fragmentation of this society, or of our societies, is no less dangerous than the threat of the Zionist project. Managing its affairs, maintaining its cohesion in light of what we are experiencing is not separated from fighting the Zionist project, but it is the core of confronting it.
Israel's attacks on Lebanon's south followed the regime's similar airstrikes on Syria in recent months. The regime has recently threatened to take military action against Iran after accusing the Islamic Republic of being involved in a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman, an allegation that Tehran has denied. The Islamic Republic has called on the United Nations Security Council to confront Israel's adventurism and reject its fabrications. Tehran says Israel is trying to distract the public attention away from the regime's crimes in the region, warning that any miscalculation on the Israeli side will be met with an immediate and crushing response.
Ibrahim Raisi is now officially the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran after his mandate was endorsed by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, at a ceremony in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei's decree endorsed the presidential mandate of Raisi. The text was read out at the event by head of the leader's office. The ceremony took place at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in Tehran in full compliance with COVID safety protocols and was attended by the country's senior state and military officials. Raisi said, through their participation in the election, the Iranian people sent a message that they are demanding change, justice, as well as a fight against corruption, poverty, and discrimination. For his part, Ayatollah Khamenei called for a swift formation of the administration and said the country's conditions do not warrant a delay in the process. Raisi is the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He won almost 62% of the votes in the June 18th presidential election and will succeed President Hassan Rouhani, who served 2 4-year terms in office. Raisi will take an oath of office in an inauguration ceremony at the Iranian parliament, or Majlis, on Thursday. But his new government is set to face a series of challenges. First and foremost, Iran's economy needs urgent action and medium-term planning to grow. Cruel and illegal U.S. sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic have severely hampered Iran's economic growth. Iran is also dealing with an unprecedented drought, which has negatively affected its energy production and its agriculture sector in certain parts of the country.
So Iran has survived the American sanctions. I think they can continue as long as they use imaginative ways of implementing the exchange of goods and services by different currencies or barter.
Raisi has pledged to prioritize Iran's domestic needs and combat poverty, unemployment, inflation, and corruption. But in order to achieve that end, a certain give and take on regional issues is necessary, and Iran can prosper by playing an even greater stability role commensurate with the country's pivotal position.
Well, in my view, I think President Raisi won't necessarily remove the sanctions, but what he will do is increase Iran's ability to circumvent them. It's possible, for example, to use other currencies than the United States dollar to pay for trading back and forth.
Raisi has vowed not to repeat his predecessor's mistake of putting nearly all the bets on the nuclear deal and the resolution of foreign-imposed sanctions. He said he will decouple his agenda from the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi has called on the U.S. to live up to its nuclear deal obligations.
I think President Raisi is talking more about countries such as Iraq and Syria and Libya and Lebanon and neighboring countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think that relying on Saudi Arabia and Israel and the Gulf states is a non-starter.
Raisi has said time and again that his government will solidify the relationship between Iran and regional countries. He's described strong ties with Iran's neighbors as important for the economy.
A somber mood prevails in Japan as the nation marks the 76th anniversary of the United States nuclear attack on the city of Hiroshima. The horrific atomic bombing was carried out during the final stages of World War II in 1945. On August 6th that year, an estimated 140,000 people were incinerated immediately under a mushroom cloud or died in the following months. Meanwhile, Japan is preparing to honor the victims of America's second nuclear strike. The bombing of the city of Nagasaki a few days later left tens of thousands of others dead. Many decades have passed since the world experienced the horrors and pain of nuclear attacks. The world doesn't truly seem to have learned a lesson from the catastrophes. Atomic weapons still pose an existential threat to humankind. There have been international calls for the total annihilation of nuclear arms worldwide. But atomic arsenals are not being dismantled or even reduced in number. They are instead being expanded and upgraded regardless of the incredible dangers and costs. The United States, which is the only country to have used nukes against another nation, is ironically leading the race to develop new nuclear weapons and modernize existing ones. The U.S. has openly accelerated the costly modernization of the American arsenal. Figures show that in recent years, America has spent heavily on its nuclear weapons program, almost as much as all other spenders like China, Britain, and Russia combined. The costs of such modernization programs run into the tens of billions of dollars each year.
I know in the United States there are very strong lobby groups that are representing the weapons industry, groups that represent companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Honeywell. These are some of the large producers of nuclear weapons. And they lobby Congress to pass more money. And what we saw is it really doesn't matter who is in the White House.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on governments to make the goal of a nuclear weapons-free world a reality. The UN chief warned that the push by nuclear weapons states to modernize their atomic arsenals has sparked a new arms race.
The U.S. now says that it needs to modernize these nuclear weapons because it's facing the adversary of China. But this is ridiculous because China has very few nuclear weapons and a much smaller military than the United States in all aspects. And it's not a time to be fueling a new race for nuclear weapons. It's a time to be recognizing that the world needs to conserve its resources to put into things like healthcare, getting rid of COVID, those kind of things, the climate issue.
The situation has undermined global security, but nuclear armed states are reluctant to even discuss disarmament. It is ironic that most of the big spenders on atomic arms are permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. They are definitely not making the world a safer place by spending more and more on such weapons of mass destruction. The United States and Russia have over 90% of all nukes worldwide, with over 14,000 warheads. America has the biggest number of deployed warheads, with hundreds of them ready to be used. India, Pakistan, and North Korea also possess nuclear weapons, but have not joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Meanwhile, Israel, which developed nuclear weapons in the 1960s with Western assistance, is the only possessor of nukes in West Asia. Israel and its supporters have blocked all efforts meant to create a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. Possessors of these weapons have defied international calls to disarm. Observers believe they are responsible for the persistent threat of nuclear war.
On Thursday, an Israeli-managed oil tanker came under attack off the coast of Oman. The Liberian-flagged and Japanese-owned vessel, dubbed Mercer Street, was reportedly on its way from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, to Fujairah in the United Arab Emirates when it was targeted. In a statement on Friday, Zodiac Maritime, the Israeli-owned firm managing the oil tanker, said that two crewmen, a Briton and a Romanian, had been killed in the assault. In recent months, several other Israeli-managed ships have come under attack on various maritime routes across the world. Israel was quick to accuse Iran of carrying out the attack, pushing for a United Nations action against Tehran. This is while Iran has denied any involvement in the attack. But that's ironic, as the regime has had more UN resolutions imposed against it than the rest of the world combined.
You know, hypocrisy in the international scene is nothing new, and we are all familiar with that. That's one point of view. Make some alliance against Iran to make it politicize actually the situation and take it to the Security Council of the United Nations to put more pressure on Iran to force the next administration to go to the negotiation table over the nuclear issue, and they hope for further talks on regional issues or missile programs and such things, but it doesn't seem to work like that, actually.
The United States and the United Kingdom have joined Israel in hurling the accusation at Iran without providing any corroborative evidence. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that Washington is confident that Iran conducted the attack on the empty Mercer Street and vowed, quote, an appropriate response. Blinken has also stated that there will be a collective response against Iran. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab also said UK assessments had concluded that it was highly likely that Iran used one or more drones to carry out the deadly attack.
Forcing their ally in the region, which is actually a regime created, actually manufactured by them in the many decades ago. So it is natural that they would support that, and they want to put pressure on Iran. We know that we are in a time of transition of power in Iran. President Raisi is going to actually take office in upcoming days. And this time is a time that they think that there can be some let's say uncertainty in the government and power in Iran. So they're trying to put pressure on the next administration actually.
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, however, has warned against any possible act of adventurism against country's interests, pledging an immediate, powerful, and serious response to any such move. A source close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that threats issued by Western officials and Israel are considered more of a propaganda gesture. The source, however, vowed any move against Iran's interests and national security will be met with Tehran's, quote, crushing and firm response, and Washington and London will be directly responsible for the consequences. There are also unconfirmed reports that Israel has gotten the green light from the U.S. to go ahead with an attack that may involve targeting an Iranian port or vessel.
It is time of transition of power in Iran, but the Westerners think that this time of transition is affecting the military power and will of Iran. But the military and the armed forces are not under the president in Iran. And so that by the change of the administration, the policies or the actually vigilance of the armed forces would change.
If the report is true, it goes to show that London and Washington have given Israel carte blanche to commit crimes with impunity. But as Iranian officials have stressed, any possible aggression won't go unanswered.
The Light.
Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain prove that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cleft decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of Fatik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now skillful artists in her workshop who design colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into an obsession, an obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea, and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment. Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewie, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days, recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tipped sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A Turkish farmer hails the miraculous survival of 2 baby goats from deadly wildfires. Sergeant Bayat said seeing his livestock threatened by flames was the most difficult moment in his life. Bayat said although he lost 8 of his animals in the fire, he found new life after the survival of a newborn goat. He said the mother of the kid had been killed in a wildfire. Bayat called it a miracle. But there was also another baby goat.
We found another goat amidst the wildfire. She has a baby. There you go. Miracle number 2.
Bayat says although his farm was severely damaged, he's now over the moon at the survival of the baby goats. The massive forest fire in southern Turkey broke out on Wednesday, fueled by strong winds. Wildfires are common in southern Turkey in the summer, but local authorities say the latest fires have covered a much bigger area.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine this how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful, but Tabby is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice. Humans have damaged the environment, perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Known in Cyprus as Birdman, 28-year-old Konstantinos Antonio is a wildlife veterinarian. Every year, he saves hundreds of sick or wounded wild birds. The animals brought to him are usually found by regular people. Konstantinos says climate change has made the task of assisting birds more urgent as their survival becomes harder and harder. The Cypriot environmentalists usually freeze the animals after treatment in the presence of other people in order to raise awareness about the issue. A vertical forest has transformed the Chinese megacity of Chengdu into a concrete jungle, making the lives of the residents greener. Each unit at the 8-tower complex has a balcony with around 20 types of luxuriant plants and greenery. The green space filters air and noise pollution while creating a spectacular view. The project in the southwestern city was completed in 2018, and all of the 826 apartments were sold out at the time.
I think it's quite good. Their quality is pretty good and much better than my old houses. The air is good when you wake up in the morning, and the green trees are good for us elderly people. They are good for our eyes.
Besides all the benefits, the apartments have a major problem. They have been overrun by plants and invaded by mosquitoes. The issue has forced some of the occupants to move out. Other cities around the world, such as New York and Copenhagen, have also launched similar green housing projects.
The best visited multimedia exhibit in the world known as Van Gogh Live. The experience has opened in Munich after being postponed a number of times due to COVID-19.
Van Gogh is just the most famous artist in the world. He is also a prototype artist. He is the last artist who then tragically dies at the end. His life story was just fascinating, and that's why he is Van Gogh. And of course, his artworks are fascinating.
Featuring some of Van Gogh's best-known works, the exhibition is not only a feast for the eyes, but the senses with music and smells to accompany the colorful projections. The exhibit is supposed to smell like the countryside because of where Van Gogh lived. However, the organizers say visitors cannot really experience the feeling due to wearing masks. Van Gogh Alive, the experience was first presented in Singapore in 2011. Since then, the multimedia exhibit has been seen in 70 cities and has attracted some 6 million visitors. Conservation measures have managed to bring the world's most endangered cat back from the brink of extinction. In 2002, there were less than 100 Iberian lynx left in the wild. The situation prompted officials in Spain and Portugal to save the animal through a captive breeding program. They also tried hard to fight poaching and reintroduce rabbits, the cat's major prey, into the wild. By the end of 2020, there were over 1,100 Iberian lynx living in the two countries, most of them in Spain's southern region of Andalusia.
The main cause of death for wildlife, certainly in the natural environment, is related to human activities. Roadkill, poaching, unwanted encounters. So the less interaction they have with humans, the better.
Despite the successful measures, the International Union for Conservation of Nature still lists the animal as endangered. It's estimated that the species will be out of danger only when its population surpasses 3,000. Urban development, hunting, and roadkill are the major reasons of death for wild lynxes these days.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.